Let's head over to the Zoom line where we have Steve Bakken on the line with us, my gracious co-host. He allows me to co-host with him every Wednesday for Wattage Wednesday, sometimes on Friday for Free for All Freedom Friday. And today we're bringing in David LaGreca with Eco Engineers. Now, this is going to be one of those multi-brand interviews, Steve, because we're going to put this out through the crude life because of the oil and gas connection. We have the carbon conversation, which is the fastest growing Substack brand and website I've ever done in my life. There's probably even some ESG involved here because of the carbon credits. We have environmental, social governance when we talk about ESG. And there's other sites too, because my guess is there's going to be other news sites, whether it be Town Square Media or the Bismarck Tribune or Forum Communications, that are going to be very interested in this interview. Dave LaGreca with Eco Engineers was one of the project individuals on, I believe it was the first carbon credit project, something along those lines. David, how are you doing today?
Hey, doing real great there, Jason. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing very good. Managing Director on Carbon Markets, Eco Engineers, Dave LaGreca. What is the exact way to phrase that carbon market, that kind of inaugural first carbon credit market that you worked on?
Yeah, so I'm very focused in the voluntary carbon market space. So there's different ways that that governments and organizations can work to reduce their emissions. And one of them is through the voluntary carbon market, where I usually say where the governments leave off, the voluntary carbon markets pick up. So the project you're referring to was a host. They were on one of your podcasts recently, Jody with Red Trail Energy. So it
Oh,
was
yeah.
the project, which we've received some fanfare for participating in, was the first ethanol-based voluntary carbon market project, and it's actually the largest durable carbon removal project to date in this nascent carbon removal market. So, depending on the audience you're in, it's a big deal or it's not. But it's 150,000 tons a year, 180,000 tons a year of durably sequestered carbon from an ethanol production facility, and we were instrumental in bringing that one to the market and helping them get registered. So that's just kind of one of the examples of projects that we've worked on recently.
Dave LaGreca is our guest. He worked on the Red Trail Energy ethanol plant with their carbon on-site carbon sequestration. Voluntary carbon market is what Dave LaGreca works in. Talk about that Red Trail Energy. Is there a advantage to doing the on-site when it comes to the voluntary carbon market? Well, first of all, before we get into that, voluntary carbon market versus involuntary carbon market, is that a thing?
Yeah, so voluntary carbon markets are been going on for about 30 years since the Kyoto Protocol in the 90s. So it's basically the last vestige of attempt to get credit and to monetize decarbonization solutions in the private sector. Governments are getting into it with discussions with Article 6 and the global push at the UN for under the Paris Accord for globalized carbon markets. But voluntary carbon markets is a relatively disaggregated approach to driving down emissions, where individuals and companies can generate credits for activities which are thoroughly validated and verified and quantified quite rigorously. Despite some mass media claims, it's a very rigorous program for claiming decarbonization and carbon removal activities. So
Dave,
yes, sir.
so Dave, question then, when you're looking at voluntary versus involuntary, what are some of the advantages? Because when I'm looking at things that companies are doing things because they choose to do so for business purposes or it's the right thing to do, versus the government's evolved, now it's a mandate and we're chasing dollars or tax credits, versus are there differences in project outcomes, type of projects, or what the basis for those projects are in that voluntary market versus a mandated market?
Yeah, and they're actually not entirely separated. So, in the case of a lot of carbon capture projects in particular, companies are chasing what's Inflation Reduction Act credit under the 45Q, or some farmers are going after 45Z. But regardless, there's tax credits that can be stacked at times with voluntary carbon projects. So, it's important to realize that voluntary carbon projects can only exist if they're not mandated. So, that's kind of the definition. So, if there is a government requirement to perform an activity or to install a certain type of equipment, it's no longer voluntary, and therefore you're not going to get credits in this market for it. But yeah, there are some distinct advantages. One is the speed at which you can advance your project compared to waiting for a legislative or a regulated process to carry through. So in the voluntary market, you have to follow what's called a carbon crediting methodology. So you have to follow all the rule book for whatever project type you're pursuing in order to generate the credits. And it's it can be a long-winded process to get to go through the process. You have to conduct a study, you have to perform your actual implementation of the project, then you have to get it validated, verified, and registered. And then you have to find an offtake partner who's going to be who values that solution. So it's not straightforward in the way that some other types of industries are, but when you can make it happen, there is a strong and growing market for quality projects that are being generated. So,
Did you say 45Z in addition to 45Q for tax credits?
I'm not saying you're stacking those two. I'm saying that like you can pursue either one or the other. Yeah.
Okay, but I'm not familiar with 45Z, so that's a new deal. And then I also want to talk about the stacking, if that's a thing or not. But the 45Z, what is that? I'm not familiar with that.
It's a forthcoming tax credit that is aimed at the renewable fuels industry for advancing sustainable aviation fuel and very low carbon intensity biofuels
It's
products.
the aviation fuel one. Okay. All right. Then I am actually kind of somewhat familiar with that. I didn't realize that was the 45Z. The stacking, I did want to ask you about the stacking because you've got the 45Q, the 40, and then they added some other things along that line. You've got sequestration, you've got storage, you've got capture, you've got research. There's at least four or five different, different pockets of money you can grab from for this. Can companies stack them? Is that a thing?
Up to a point, yes. I mean the registry which we registered Red Trail Energy under was the Puro Earth Registry. It was the first carbon removal registry really out the gate, and they're doing quite well at this moment in time. And that their requirement for what's called additionality is this project has to be above and beyond what would have happened in the absence of some kind of carbon revenue. So in the instance of Red Trail, we built out the case in point that their project was not economically viable without some form of carbon revenue. You know, they were pursuing LCFS, they were pursuing Canadian registration, Oregon, but because those markets are in flux, they needed the optionality to also pursue carbon revenue from the removals credits. So when stacking comes into place, it's a particular type of process. You can't just layer things on and get double counted and get additional revenues to the end of the days. You really have to make sure that those other incoming sources of revenue don't make your project viable on their own. And if they do, great, go for it and have a fantastic project. But voluntary markets are here to push projects forward that otherwise can't happen. So in the case of like ethanol capture, the US Energy Information Administration, the DOE, has claims for like $35 a ton capture cost. In the field and from discussions with numerous facilities, that's actually not accurate when you take into account the full price of capture and installation of this equipment. So where the voluntary market comes in is, say you're getting $85 a ton on 45Q, but your true cost of capture is at 110. The voluntary market's going to help you cover that gap and make your project hit FID and actually get off the ground. So, you know, you can stack certain types of incentives, but nothing with carbon directly tied into it. So You can't stack a LCFS credit with a carbon credit because they're both embody the carbon attribute. So sorry to get wonky on you so early in the morning.
No,
but...
that's
no,
okay.
No, no,
it's,
no.
Steve, it's kind of like the McDonald's app. You can't put the free fries with the free McDonald's apple pie. You know, you can only pick one.
Well, maybe on the app. I don't know. I don't have the app, but maybe on the app because they run a lot of secret specials on the app, kind of like Starbucks with the secret Starbucks menu. But Dave, talk a little bit about Red Trail because we've had the CEO on, and it's really a great story here in North Dakota as a cooperative. I guess functions more as that with a member-owned facility for the benefit of the farmers growing corn, a little different than what's taking place here in North Dakota, South Dakota, across the upper Midwest with Summit Carbon Solutions proposed CO2 pipeline. That's more, I view that as a conglomerate of chasing the credits. Very, very different projects for very different reasons. Can you intimate about that a little bit on why Red Trail? Because I view Red Trail as kind of special here in North Dakota.
Yeah, they've been a really good partner of Eco Engineers for a number of years, working on various pathways into regulated markets. It's a different approach to than a lot of the kind of major corporate type of angles. I've worked with a number of ethanol facilities who are pursuing the same type of revenue stream in order to make their projects viable in the voluntary market. So, you know, there's a pretty solid pipeline of companies pursuing this angle. And with the growth of the carbon removals market in the recent days, it's, you know, it's becoming an important part of a lot of these business plans for ethanol facilities to kind of diversify their incomes. You know,
Okay.
Go ahead.
Which brings up an interesting question, though, because like the business model for Red Trail versus the business model of Summit, where Red Trail's sequestering locally at their facility for the credits and the carbon side of being green, and not the business model for Summit. They want to stick it someplace else and sequester it someplace else. Is there a difference in those types of projects in the space that you work?
I'd say the life cycle assessment boundary is different, right? Because there's going to be more equipment and more distance traveled. So there's going to be more, you know, impacts that are taken into effect. You know, Summit is much like its predecessor, the now defunct Navigator project, is having to deal with a lot of issues with community involvement, whereas like Red Trail didn't. It was either their property or a very closely adjacent property into a Broom Creek formation, which is just a geologic storage formation that is very conveniently located near their facility. A lot of these other facilities across the Midwest have no conducive geology, so to access storage sites, they have to participate in some kind of transportation. You know, if it's short distance, some of them might be able to do like truck transport, but at the end of the day, they all have to get it into a durable Class 6 storage site. So, you know, the projects are going to be different in the cost of development, because you have to build up the pipeline, you have to, and Summit has to deal with numerous facilities across their entire system. And as you're probably aware, they probably come to your town meetings. I'm not sure, Steve, but they're having to petition.
No, they have not been. I keep asking. They have not been to a county commission meeting yet. So, but I keep asking. They have not shown up. I find it interesting, though, because
Steve, we should mention you are the Burley County chairman,
currently vice chair. Yeah.
Excuse me. And former mayor of Bismarck. So you do pay attention.
Yeah, I do. But I find it fascinating that, you know, on some of this, because when I'm thinking of these projects and when you're chasing the tax credits, and I'm thinking scope, I'm thinking these are massive projects. And I find it interesting that you said, well, truck transport is even an option with some of these projects, because I'm thinking in that's a smaller scope. That's a really smaller scale. And it didn't even occur to me that truck transport would be an option for a CO2 sequestration project.
That's the thing about when you're looking for access to different markets. Sometimes you do very creative things. So this voluntary carbon market drives people to be very innovative and creative. You know, everything from a company we've worked with pursuing carbon capture directly from vehicles and then transporting it to storage. Otherwise, you know, there's carbon capture from renewable natural gas facilities, even from, you know, coal-powered plants. There's a facility in North Dakota, maybe even two, that are pursuing carbon capture on such facilities, mm-hmm. whether it's voluntarily conducted or whether it's required, depending on the outcome of current court cases on that issue. But you really have to be nimble in order to participate in the tax credit schemes. But in the voluntary markets, you're going to really leverage the type of activities you're already pursuing or that you're intending to do to drive further carbon reductions in your industry. So, you know, if you're in a steel facility and you're trying to drastically reduce the carbon intensity of your steel product and you're not required to do so, you know, you can decide on a mechanism for reduction of your of that intensity by changing to electric arc furnaces or doing some other activity. You know, in farming, it's soil carbon practices, and that's we're doing a lot of work right now on kind of assurance and verification processes and scope 3 reductions for agriculture. And that's also, you know, ties in very nicely to the carbon capture for Red Trail and for the ethanol industry that we're pushing forward, trying to gain adoption and grow adoption in of companies, like really reaching out and finding the incentives that are available to them through, you know, legislated credits as well as voluntary actions that are taken by corporations.
About 10 years ago, I started writing, actually it was 12 years ago, I started writing about the merger of ag and energy. Mm-hmm. And then about 5 years ago, I started adding the carbon in there, called it the Ag Energy Carbon Trilogy, or Trinity, if you will. Because really, I started seeing how they were working together. And then, I'm not kidding you, a couple of years ago in Colorado, they opened up the, I think it was the Carbon and Energy Management. They actually put the two together. And so we're just a step away from the ag, energy, carbon. And that's where I see this ethanol. Really, it's going to merge ag and energy together like never before, but through that catalyst of carbon, if you will. When we look at the six different ethanol plants in North Dakota, there's only one that's piping into the ethanol pipeline, the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline. Red Trail Energy did the on-site sequestration as opposed to a pipeline. I understand there are geographical reasons for that. The geography underneath your ethanol plant has to be porous enough in order to hang on to that carbon. So some ethanol plants cannot do it. Some can. Did Red Trail have to do any sort of study to find out whether the geography was able to store underneath, or did they always know that? Talk about that process a little bit, because my understanding is not every ethanol plant can do on-site.
That's very true. You know, with regards to Red Trail, they spent, I believe, two or three years on that initial geologic study and evaluating the economics and the viability of it. Also, while they're waiting for North Dakota to gain primacy, and which means that they have the ability to make the decision on behalf of the EPA for whether or not a site is eligible to reach the distinction of having a Class 6 permit, which is kind of the, mm-hmm. you know, it's based on water quality characteristics and preservation of environment. And
we dumb it down on the radio, we call it the super EPA clause in North Dakota.
EPA clause.
Yeah, Wyoming has it, North Dakota has it, and Louisiana just got it right around the beginning of the year. Primacy. So
yeah,
the super EPA primacy, where they can actually make a lot of their own decisions in state without having to go through the federal EPA process. So anyways, go ahead. Sorry, Dave.
No, it's quite all right. It's just basically, that just means that there's equal protections as would be afforded under the federal permitting process. So yeah, Red Trail did perform that. That was not something I was directly involved in, but every single sequestration site in the country has to go through a similar process. There's other carbon removals, such as done by like a Charm Industrial, who has storage, but it's not in a class six. It's in a like a class two or a class five type well, where it's just a different type of permitting, a different type of durability, but they're putting biogenic materials into deep geologic storage for perpetuity, and that's in pursuit of chasing these carbon removal credits. So, you know, the sequestration angle is not limited exclusively to ethanol, although it is, they're taking off with it at a quicker clip than just about any industry.
Dave, talk a little bit about that juncture between energy and agriculture, because carbon and CO2 and carbon in general is just it is such a midpoint between two industries that traditionally had worked in different spaces but have come together more and more and more over the last decade. Where do you see that evolution of the synergy between energy and agriculture going?
Yeah, I think that that Trinity that Jason was speaking of is very, I think it's very alive and it's enhancing. So everything between in ag and energy, it's, you know, the most clear-cut portion of that is the tie between agriculture and production of biofuels. You know, it's a one-to-one connection. The one-to-one-to-one connection is ag to biofuels, incorporating carbon intensity evaluations for measurement of emission reductions throughout the supply chain. So I think that's a very direct tie-in. It also ties into food and agriculture for actual like human consumption and animal consumption purposes, where you're tying in that carbon intensity of production and the impacts on soil carbon storage, for instance, or for the crop practices, the farm practices of the types of nitrogen fertilizers you're using, the amounts, the right place, right time, right amount type approach to agricultural enhancement. You know, the government right now is on a they're increasingly specifying the amount of diligence that you have to take to make claims on agriculture. You know, they're updating the GREET model, which is like the carbon intensity model, with relative frequency, providing some guidance under the 40B initiative, under the 40B for those tax credits for advanced biofuels. In addition, they're doing there's carbon crediting approaches. You know, Indigo Ag kind of piloted some of that a little while ago, with development of a Verra protocol, actually, for improving crop practices and getting carbon credits for verified claims for actions. You know, Climate Action Reserve is another registry who's done that quite well with direct claims in there. And then also, we wrote a I was involved in writing a methodology with Andes, which is a soil microbial mineralization company. So using microbes to store inorganic carbon in soils, to kind of, and it also having a concomitant benefit of enhancing the benefit, the like functionality of the soil. So, you know, the projects that work the best in carbon markets are the ones that have the most types of benefits. You know, the ones that have multiple angles of improving human and environmental life, as well as the impacts on storage of carbon or removing it. And when you tie that in with the biofuel space, then you improve transportation, you improve the efficiency of you know, the decarbonization of transportation sector, which is huge. So, you know, there's no
So,
shortage of controversy within each of these angles, but
like a lot of things, the more you can diversify that those projects, the better the outcome. You mentioned the ag side of stuff, and CO2 is, carbon. It's the building block of life. When you start looking at the augmentation of plant life with CO2. There's a lot of space that we haven't even gotten into there with potentials for different projects. So, some fascinating stuff. And I do have to check out here. I've got a doctor's appointment I got to get into. But I look forward to having a conversation with you again further. We'll love to have you back on again, and I'll let you continue with Jason.
Sounds great.
So,
See you. Look forward to the next time.
yeah, Dave, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Good luck at the doctor, Steve.
All
All
right.
right.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Dave LaGreca, Eco Engineers. Just a few questions left here. Managing Director of the Voluntary Carbon Markets. Look at that. I even put the voluntary back in there.
Nice.
Left it out in the beginning. I educated myself. I didn't realize the difference between voluntary carbon markets and, non-voluntary or involuntary carbon markets. I knew they were there. It registered for the first time today, the difference between them. And one of the things that's interesting about the carbon market, and I'm not trying to get political here, I'm not even trying to get into any sort of ethos argument from an existential energy or economy point of view, but it seems a lot of this carbon market is being directed from the government and from some of these Inflation Reduction Acts and some of the different deals. Talk to me about that a little bit, because it is disrupting the marketplace a little bit to where there needs to be a new approach to how businesses approach the carbon market versus the old wildcatting, just going out there and finding a piece of dirt and let's see what we can get, put it out in the free market and see how it goes. Those days are gone. They really are. There's so many steps you have to go through. We talked to the Red Dirt Energy individuals last week, and we were talking about the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management. I did a story 10 years ago with the Native American tribes trying to, drill on the reservation. They had to go through a 47-step process versus the private company 3 days. 3 days you can go out versus the 47-step process, which is like a 2-year process. So when we talk about the difference of, the free market versus a subsidized or a managed market, that's really what I see happening here. And like I said, I'm not trying to get political with this. I'm not trying to get into any sort of ethos argument. I'm just trying to more of an educational for people out there. Meridian Carbon, for example, he said straight up, he said, "Oh, the government's directing this market 100%." And then you've got Oxy changing their name to a carbon management company, and Exxon buying Denbury specifically for their carbon pipeline business, so you can see the shift in the marketplace a little bit. Talk to me about what your experience has been just in that realm, because going from wildcatting to carbon management, man, that's like 180 turn for a lot of people.
Yeah, I'd say the US government's doing a number of things. So taking a step back, I think there's been a call from people in the voluntary carbon market for, I don't know, decades, trying to just make every action mandatory. But in my opinion is the voluntary carbon market is by necessity what fits in the gaps between compliance obligations in different industries. So, at last count, there's somewhere between 170 and 200 carbon crediting methodologies for to receive credits across the voluntary markets. Everything from planting forests and restoring mangroves to capping oil and gas wells and performing carbon removal actions like we're talking about with Red Trail Energy and sequestration. So, across that 200 project types, 200 methodologies, the governments touch a handful of them. The governments are in the background for many of these different industries. For landfill gas capture, they have a standard for a new source performance standard. It's a certain amount of emissions you have to cap your you have to plumb your landfill, for instance, and collect the natural gas, the renewable natural gas, and destroy it in some manner or another. And that you know so that and that ties into the renewable fuel standard program in the U.S. But for everything under that threshold, there is voluntary carbon market potential. Same thing with carbon management, is there, if they're going to call it that. The government's going to set thresholds and allow for certain and require certain industries to incorporate those type of actions. Like in Colorado, there's a initiative for requiring carbon capture, not by name but by practice. They're saying the best available technology must be installed in certain big emitting industries. And so that it kind of creates a mandate for that, for those actions to be taken, which would have otherwise been voluntary for driving down some kind of a carbon intensity in that industry. So there's a lot of overlap. And at the same time, the Department of Energy is putting tens of millions of dollars into carbon purchase prizes for innovative new carbon removal projects. They're putting funding out for 45Q, and by proxy, they're putting funding out for farm practice improvements through 40B, 45Z, and other kinds of programs that we could get into in a more wonky context. But you know, and I'd say that there is a strong migration of the voluntary and the compliance markets to coalesce. You know, at the UN level, every year we listen to the parties banter about, and at the Conference of the Parties, the COP conferences, and you know, try to align voluntary and regulated carbon practices. But at the end of the day, the voluntary market is there to drive society forward. Governments can only push from the front, and voluntary carbon markets are dragging the rest of civilization along for the ride.
We mentioned the EPA is kind of at the core for some of this when it comes to emission management, carbon management. There's another acronym, Environmental Social Governance, ESG. It has to do with the financing more than anything. Is that involved with this at all? Are you experiencing any sort of ESG, either forward movement or pushback or anything along those lines? A lot of acronyms seem to be polarizing these days.
Yeah, and I try to avoid all of them because we just want to like do positive projects that most people would agree should happen, right? So once you start putting like culture war labels on things, it's like really tough to get anything along. So you know, but ESG, as you asked, is one of the fundamental drivers. Companies trying to better their environmental impacts or to reduce them. So some of that is sustainability reporting. Some of that is corporate ambitions and targets for net zero. You know, Microsoft has been a major leader in the carbon markets for a decade or longer. They're the biggest purchasers of carbon removal credits by far, trying to neutralize all of the emissions that they've had since their inception. So within that context, a lot of the big tech companies are doing the same. Even Shell is the largest buyer. I mean, I don't know if they are this year, but they're amongst the largest buyers of carbon credits and financers of carbon projects, largely due to their quite enormous impacts on carbon emissions throughout their supply chain. But yes, ESG is the primary driver of these carbon markets for purposes of companies purchasing credits for either contribution claims, saying, "Hey, we're helping out with decarbonization activities beyond our own value chain," or driving them direct, like agriculture players buying and direct developing projects within their supply chain to reduce the emissions intensity of crop cultivation. Or it can happen in literally any industry where you're trying to decarbonize. You look for the pain points either above you in the supply chain or who you're selling to, or downstream, who's buying your product from you, and figuring out the best places to put your money to drive down those emissions. And because it's darn near impossible to eliminate 100% of any company's emissions, there's usually residual emissions in your supply chain. So that's going to require that you do some kind of a mitigation activity, either through purchasing of carbon avoidance, carbon removal, or carbon removal credits, or direct decarbonization, like funding projects yourselves. So ESG is a major driver. You know, by term, you know, I think those three letters should be like totally separated. So there's not just one behemoth for certain groups to bludgeon and attack people with. But you know, because like most companies now are on board with some type of environmental improvement. Social, it gets a little funky depending on what state you're in. And then the governance is corporate governance and how you run your company, what rules you live by. So combining all three of those gets a little bit fuzzy. But yeah, I mean, it's still growing. It's just changing in name, what kind of companies participate in which one of those three portions.
I tell people that, you know, ESG in a vacuum, it's great. like most things, in a vacuum. It's fantastic, you know, but when it becomes political, it becomes weaponized, and it becomes just polarizing. And then you get away from the, like you said, the good projects that stand on their own merit. And that's where a lot of these things come from, whether it's Joe Biden pumping out $40 trillion or it's ESG wanting us to have environmental social governance concerns, or even the other acronym DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. That's even somewhat related in a lot of this through the financing part of things. So we talk, you know, when we talk about the driver, whether it be the EPA or ESG, you know, from the regulatory and the finance side of things, there is a conduit to all this, another acronym. And you mentioned Microsoft. You know, AI, artificial intelligence, really is going to be the connector for all this. When we're talking about the ag to energy carbon trinity, you know, we're talking about AI drones, we're talking about AI software, we're talking about reduction of pesticides by 90%, we're talking about these types of amazing, like we're talking within a couple of years, once this next wave of software and AI gets integrated in, you're going to see reductions happen. Like it's going to be a sharp drop, in my opinion, especially in the farming side of things, when you can get in precision agriculture versus just shotgun approach type of a thing. How are you seeing the AI being integrated into this next chapter of acronyms that we're looking at driving our workplace?
Yeah, I have to say we have a strong cohort of companies who are pursuing project development, who are trying to incorporate AI to some degree. And the companies who aren't yet probably will, with the exception of a handful of things that don't need to be improved, but there's not a lot of things in that category anymore. So there's a client, AI Crete, with whom we've worked. They're enhancing the efficiency, the carbon intensity of concrete production, for instance. Fantastic group, using artificial intelligence and kind of machine learning processes to enhance that type of improvements within the concrete sector. Seeing AI in energy grid management, seeing AI in groups like Watt Time, doing time, you know, basically driving the efficiency of usage of energy from different devices by what time of day the grid is the cleanest. You know, so turning on your devices based on, you know, the Internet of Things, turning on and off devices based on the most efficient time to use that. There's a number of other companies doing similar things. I've seen AI be used for validation and of carbon stocks, so allowing drones or, you know, some kind of a remote sensing technology to kind of confirm or refute the amount of carbon within a certain forest stock for avoided deforestation projects. I'm seeing AI in most places. it's kind of sinking in, and I think primarily it's for the best. Where it's, you know, where it's detrimental with you know, taking over some of the creativity or you know, taking jobs or whatever. I think that's quite possible, but we're all just evolving and trying to use it for the advantages of improving efficiency and getting more, you know, getting more projects done at a lower cost. And that's where I see it having the best advantage, taking what a human would take years to potentially calculate and quantify and do it much quicker. And it's also working with digital, you know, with the digitization of monitoring, reporting, and verification. There's AI incorporated in some of those type processes, and I'm honestly kind of bullish and excited to see how it can drive efficiency, especially in the electricity sector, going forward.
Two more questions for Dave LaGreca. David LaGreca, Eco Engineers, Managing Director for Voluntary Carbon Markets. He was one of the individuals worked on Red Trail Energy, which has the first carbon credit program, right? First carbon credit program, essentially. Is that a correct way to put it?
For ethanol.
For ethanol.
Ethanol and carbon removals, yep.
You know, when I take a look at that, and the question I have for you is about the ethanol industry. Red Trail Energy, I mentioned before, is one of six ethanol plants in the state of North Dakota. Tharaldson ethanol is going to pipe into the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline, which has, I've lost track, but it's well over 35 ethanol plants now. I think 37, it might be up to 47 now, 45 across 5-6 states. Terminus is going to be in North Dakota. And, you know, one of the things that people talk about in North Dakota is why only one? You know, there's 6 other ethanol plants. One of them did on-site storage. One is going into the pipeline. Is there a what would be the just very quick advantage, disadvantage of going into a pipeline versus on site? Is it all economics? Is there other reasons, you know, like I know some ethanol plants, you know, one parent company owns like 6 of them. So obviously there's some logistical reasons that might be more beneficial for them. But one of the questions people have in North Dakota is why is there only one out of the 6 plants, you know? And then of course the other one did on site. So there is some of that confusion a little bit. Is there an easy answer for this? Because I don't think there is, but some people think there is, but is there kind of a benefit of doing pipeline versus on-site or vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, it's really going to depend on where the project is in the development phase too. I don't know the specifics of all those plants, but some of them are farther behind and some of them are farther ahead on their CCS plans. And some of them, you know, the cost curve is not at the right spot for them to even pursue this yet. They don't have the demand signal to or the competitive requirement to install it yet. Alternative, but to answer your question more directly, it's going to be a logistics and an expertise and a cost. Those three mm-hmm. pieces are really going to drive that decision for those plants. So if you don't have the expertise in house and you don't want to manage a pretty gargantuan process for getting the permitting and the establishing the geologic functionality to do those test wells and to perform all of the geologic studies necessary to store on site, you know, and you might be land ownership might be an issue. There's a lot of private land issues. You don't want to, you know, that creates some complexity, and then also distance to pipeline. Because pipeline costs X number of millions of dollars per mile to build, and Summit's not going to go way out in the middle of nowhere for another 100,000 tons a year. There's probably some threshold for Summit to make it worthwhile as yeah. well. So, you know, that's, and some of those plants are just going to be too far afield to pursue it. And if they do, it might have to be on their own once that happens. So geography and geology plays a huge role, but it's also a huge pain in the ass to do these projects. So you got to be really committed. You talked to Jody about it. I mean, it was a process of persistence, and she was very understated in the talking about how much effort they put into it. So all these facilities are doing the same, and if they don't have the resources, I could see it being a hard thing to push over the line.
So how does somebody get into it? Kind of final question here. Is this, if somebody out there listening is wanting to get into the voluntary carbon market, what's the best way to do it? You know, is there a certain size of a company? Is there a certain protocols that you have to go through? I'm not sure if like a Dinky Donuts is going to do any carbon capture. I'm sure there is a program for small businesses, but I mean, we're talking about some of the bigger scale ones here. How does somebody get involved?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It's going to depend on which industry you're in, but to begin with, you have to be doing something that is innovative. You have to be doing something that is, it doesn't have to be the first time it's ever happened, but some kind of process which is driving a significant amount of quantifiable emission reductions or carbon removals from your business activities or from an activity that you're doing specifically for purposes of accessing carbon credit markets. So it's going to be very different if you're operating a landfill facility than if you are operating a small forest farm. So if you have a small forestry project, you're probably going to want to evaluate the government incentive programs for keeping your forest standing or for improving the forest management practices on your site. there's large companies and small who are kind of facilitating those types of activities. And then there's also a lot of companies who are going to probably try to convince you that you have a play when it might not be economically viable for you. So, you know, I'd say seeking out the right kind of expertise and not just taking whatever is initially sold to you is the end all be all, because it's always more complicated and you're probably going to get slightly fewer credits than is in the back of your head. But if you're trying to participate in the purposes of a large scale industrial decarbonization action, you really want to see on the just back of the napkin through a evaluation, working with myself and my colleagues at Eco Engineers, trying to figure out the viability of your project. So project feasibility study is going to be quite different than a feasibility study that you're going to perform for actually developing the asset, but it's going to be going to go through the process of walking you through to see, is there a methodology out there? Is this, what are the risks of participating? Is there actually a market for buyers for this type of credits? If you're, you know, if you're at a Dinky Donuts, like you mentioned, you're gonna wanna make sure that there's no like skeletons in your closet of your company, because I'd say the VCM has somewhat of a cancel culture nature to it in the recent days, where you know, everybody has to be performing at impeccable levels, and that's mostly for the best, right? You want to make sure that you're not funding projects that have any kind of negative side to them. You don't want anything. You have to be incredibly transparent. So as we discussed with Red Trail and all of our clients, you have to be willing to really open the kimono for the world to evaluate your project and your corporate practices to depict what you're doing and it's real light. So, you know, transparency is one of the core carbon principles, and it is certainly an important one. You need to be willing to be verified and validated on a consistent basis, and you've got to be willing to work with multiple parties in the process. Very few companies are going to be able to go it alone and be their entire in-house project development, project management, and marketing arm. You're going to have to develop partnerships and relationships with consultants, with potentially with brokers or with others who have contacts in the market, and then also with scientists or engineers, depending on what industry you're in. So you know, just really take a solid look at what you think you have as far as decarbonization, and you know, if it's of significant worth and you think there's a great value there, pursue it. Give me a call, because we evaluated probably some 40 projects over the last year and a half, from everything from you know, improved water flow through faucets, improved steel processes, enhanced rock weathering, geologic storage from ethanol. Like there's no shortage of awesome ideas out there, and you know, don't be afraid to consider it, but don't be offended if there's not a game that's available for every single process. You know, some categories have fantastic impacts, but don't quite meet the threshold of viability. So basically, just keep doing the great actions you're doing, and we'll see if we can and I'll see if we can tie you into a marketplace for those types of actions within supply chain, somebody else's supply chain, because everybody's emissions are in somebody else's supply chain. So if you fall into that category, look into it and get a second opinion, because it's you know, there's mostly good players out there, but you want to just make sure you're getting the best deal, and you're not overlooking any impacts that any benefits that you could be gaining. And big companies may have more than one possibility for access to markets as well for their various activities. So it's worth doing a thorough scrub, and that's one of the things I like doing, is finding viability for projects that would otherwise get shelved. And that's kind of what gets me moving, is driving these really great projects with cool people that otherwise would fall to the wayside if there weren't access to these voluntary markets.
David LaGreca, Eco Engineers, is our guest, Managing Director of Voluntary Carbon Markets. Kind of last question here for you. You worked on the ethanol plant, the Red Trail Energy, which was first carbon ethanol credit plant, and process, that sort of thing. Who is your customer? I mean, is it ethanol plants? Is it just big projects, municipalities. You know, involuntary carbon markets can probably go a lot of different directions, but at the same time, I imagine you guys are somewhat selective with clients and that sort of thing. Talk about who your customer base is and how you guys go about getting them.
Yeah, within the ethanol space, we have a long-standing history in that industry. Eco Engineers started about 15 years ago with a couple of guys out of Des Moines, Iowa, and so the company started to help companies comply with new regulations, and then to access the forthcoming renewable fuel standard and other fuel markets in California. So basically, we've kind of cultivated this following of people within many different sectors. So like we have oil major clients. We have dozens of ethanol production facility clients. We also have, in my category, startups that have venture funded startups, and some self-funded, but mostly venture funded startups who are working to create a new carbon stream, new carbon revenue stream. So the market is accessible to everything from the largest corporations in the world, who may actually be in a better place to either develop projects themselves or to purchase large volumes of credits that really are the flywheel for the market to continue, or for small to medium-sized enterprises who are working to develop new landfill gas capture projects or energy efficiency devices that are incredibly impactful in the developing world, and in the U.S. context as well. So basically, companies with unique ideas that have a very provable, justifiable claim that can be made is really our target clientele. You know, we do some marketing for sure at our company. We have a great arm doing that, but most of our business comes from honestly referrals and other companies. Hey, I saw you guys worked on this project. I saw you guys wrote this brand new carbon removals methodology. Can you do that for us? Or I saw that you worked on the Red Trail project. Can you help us do the same thing? We have a strong following that end, and you know, based on our kind of unreal team of PhDs, scientists, environmental scientists, engineers, we're able to work with a vast variety of clientele, and it's really cool to see the coalescence of all these industries in this market.
Well, you know what they say, word of mouth advertising is the best, so buy as much as you can. That's what I tell people. And then the influencer market took off. You see what I'm saying? So, do you got a website? That's usually the best place for people to start.
Yeah, you can certainly find me on LinkedIn, David LaGreca. Ecoengineers.us is our company website. And come give us a call. We'd love to chat.